You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is home to the nation's largest population of Yemeni Americans, somewhere north of 10,000. And what first brought Yemenis to Michigan? Well, for many, economic opportunity that could be found on the Great Lakes. There's a long but little-known history of Yemeni sailors on the Great Lakes. Sally Howell is an associate professor of history at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, where she directs the Center for Arab American Studies. Sally, welcome back.
Thank you, Cindy. It's so good to be here.
And we welcome Jalal Albana. He is Yemeni American, and a year ago, he graduated from the Great Lakes Maritime Academy. So good to have you here, Jalal.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Sally, take us back. Let's take that historical view. When people from Yemen first cast their eye toward the Great Lakes and decided they wanted to emigrate to cities like Detroit or cities like Buffalo, New York, when was this and why?
Well, that's actually the one question I don't have the answer to. We're still trying to figure out the point of origin of this narrative. We know that Yemenis, they were merchant marines working for the British Navy, starting when the British colonized the port of Aden. So this is a long history. And before the British got to Aden and colonized that port, it was part of their Indian Empire. The Yemeni sailors, especially from the Hadramaut region of Yemen, they sort of dominated trade in the Indian Ocean.
So and they had 1,200 miles of coastline. So these exactly. are people that know the ocean.
Yeah, they knew the ocean. And they were the most experienced traders, the most experienced sailors. And this is how Islam actually spread to places like Indonesia. It was through these Indians who were intellectual elites as well as merchants and religious authorities all at the same time. So there's that history, which is very different from the narrative about Lebanese Americans or other groups coming to America. The Yemeni route to America actually goes through the Indian Ocean, not through the Mediterranean like everyone else's. So I don't know when it actually started. There are rumors that people were here as early as the 1880s. There are rumors that Henry Ford, as early as like the 1912, 1914, that period, already had an interest in Yemeni sailors. Like the British, Ford had these attitudes about people based on where they come from. So if you come from a tropical environment like Yemen or India, he thought that those people were best to work in the engine rooms of the ships because they were from these hot climates. They could shovel coal all day long. So that was the role that most of the Yemenis played for the British. They were like the Bangladeshi workers working for the British, the Lascars, they called them, who had this sort of very intense labor-oriented job where you worked in the bowels of the ship just shoveling coal all day long. So not the most pleasant job. But fast forward to the 20th century, and we see of the sailors that we've been interviewing for my class, most of them started coming to America in the 1950s. And when they came to America, they did not have good English skills. And at the time, if you wanted to work for Henry Ford or GM or any of the big three, you needed to be able to speak English or you couldn't get hired on the line. But they could get hired on the ships.
So that was the outlet.
That was the outlet. They started working on the ships.
And what was bringing them in the 1950s? I mean, we know that there's much turmoil today in Yemen. What was the driver of emigration in the 50s?
In the 50s, it was basically a lack of economic opportunity in Yemen. And it really heated up more in the 60s. There was a revolution in the 1960s, and they overthrew a ruler who had been something like a dictator, had really kept the country isolated from the rest of the world. And the economy of the countryside had received no investment at all. Education opportunities were very minimal. And so people needed work. They needed to support their families. And once they started coming to America, they found that even though they were not in high-income jobs here in America, they could send money home. And part of the reason people like the ships is because if traditionally the early immigrants who came were men. And if you're on a ship, your meals are taken care of. Your housing is taken care of. You have no expenses. All of your income you can just save and send right home to the village. So it was a very attractive job for them.
And so I'm interested, Jalal, what turned you to becoming a sailor on the Great Lakes?
I know a lot of people that have sailed and that are currently sailing.
In your family? Do you have a family history of this?
I do. I have a few family members that are sailing. And friend of the family, I look at him like my uncle. I've known him since I was a little kid. He's sailed since, I want to say, 95. And mentioned it to my father. He's like, well, go ahead and talk to your uncle because I know he's been sailing for a long time. Maybe he can give you a few pointers and help you get where you need to go. So I went and I spoke with him and he told me, he's like, well, if you're really serious and you would really like to join this industry, he goes, you should go to school, get your education. I'm like, what entails with that? What is it that you got to do?
Where do I go and what do I learn?
Right.
Yeah.
So he told me to go to the Great Lakes Maritime Academy and that he had known somebody that is currently an instructor there. contacted the academy, set up orientation date, went, spoke with them, and didn't look back.
Tell me about your job. What do you do?
So I'm a third assistant engineer. So an engineer, essentially on board any ship, is responsible for making sure that ship goes. A ship essentially is a pretty much a floating city on water. And we make and produce our own electricity. We use our own electricity. If you're sailing on the Great Lakes, you have an unlimited supply of fresh water. So there isn't really much that you have to do besides, you know, filter it and things like that. But when you're sailing oceans, you have an unlimited supply of salt water. So we have the machinery that we use, evaporator, and it helps, you know, distill the water, which essentially turns it into drinkable water. And that's one other thing that we are responsible for making water on the ship. You know, whether it's for cleaning dishes, whether it's for sanitary reasons, or whether it's for taking a shower, and most essentially for drinking, you know, so nobody dies of dehydration.
So it's keeping the ship running, keeping the water good, so you have to be good in many things.
Right.
Could you take the skills, Jalal, that you learned at the Great Lakes Maritime Academy, and could you also then do ocean vessels? Are they very applicable?
Yes. I've actually worked both on the Great Lakes, okay. And I've worked oceans. I just got back, actually, from an ocean-going ship about a month ago.
Okay.
So.
And are jobs available? Is this a good outlet for people who are not sure where they want to go and what they want to do, but gee, there are jobs on ships?
There are. There's tons of jobs. There's many vessels, whether it's on the Great Lakes or it's oceans, lots of jobs available. And it just essentially depends on what is it that you like to do. A lot of people like to see the sun all the time. They want to watch the sunrise and they want to see the sunset. Those are going to be more for guys that are going to be oriented on the deck. Somebody like me, it doesn't really matter if there's sun out or not. I mean, I work in an engine room, so, you know, depending on the ship, you know, 20, 30 feet below water at all times when I'm working. So occasionally you get to see the stars and get to see the sun, but, you know, whether I see it or not, I don't trip.
So there are career prospects, and there's room for growth, there's room for promotions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have two categories when it comes to the personnel that are on board. Mm-hmm. You have your officers and you have your unlicensed personnel. And you can start from the bottom, deckhand, wiper. Deckhand is going to be for on deck, and then the wiper is going to be somebody that's working in the engine room, and they can advance all the way up to a captain if they're working on deck. And from the engine room side, you can start off at a wiper and work your way up to be a chief engineer.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the long but little-known history of Yemeni sailors on the Great Lakes, as we talk with Sally Howell, who directs the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and Jalal Albana, who is Yemeni American and is a sailor, does ocean and Great Lakes ships, and went to the Great Lakes Maritime Academy to get, is that a degree? Is that like a four-year degree that
yes,
you get?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's a bachelor's in science and maritime engineering.
Now, Sally, I know every semester you have your students kind of do a big public history project, and this is what you're focusing on, Yemeni sailors in the Great Lakes. So what's the goal? What's the mission of this project?
So the class focuses on sort of a public history project. So we find something that has been not really written about very much in the literature, and then we do research on it. And then the end goal is for the students to produce some sort of public project with the work. So last year we created an exhibition on the history of Iraqi refugees in this area. This year we're working on this Yemeni project. And the final class project, they have to do their reveal to the public. We're inviting all the people we interviewed to come back in and see them and people from the public. They're working right now on a website. But over the summer, we're going to go to Maryland, where the Seafarers International Union has their headquarters, and we're going to interview people there. We're going to go to the National Archive and look into some immigration records so we can trace the early history of this. And the end goal will be we're going to add to the collection of the Arab American National Museum, which covers the history of Arab American culture, and we're going to make sure that they have a part of their museum that tells the story of Yemenis on the Great Lakes, because they have been a part of the economy of this region for at least 70 years, from what we've been able to document,
right.
At least 70 years.
If
not longer. And a major part of that economy. I mean, the coal that fires our factories in the state of Michigan is brought to these ports by Yemeni laborers. And
the
wood.
As well as the power plants.
I mean, it's amazing. The grain that moves through the lakes is moved by Yemeni labor.
Right.
What else are we moving around the Great Lakes?
One major resource that we haul is iron ore, which is one of the major components to steelmaking. and all the steel mills that are located, you know, in the basin of Lake Michigan, Cleveland over in Lake Erie, they all need the raw material, and we help move that raw material, essentially.
Yeah. So that's our purpose was just to, we understand that these people are contributing to the economy and it's a story that's not being told. So our goal is to do as much research as we can. We've interviewed 24 seafarers over the course of the summer. The students I'll be working with this summer hope to interview the wives and the children of the Yemeni seafarers because this way of life is stressful for families.
I can imagine. I was wondering what it's like. I know you're the father of two.
Right.
How long are you typically gone?
It depends. When I'm working on the lakes, I'm usually doing relief work. So I go and I being pretty much like a substitute teacher. So there's an engineer who's already working on board and they have their permanent schedule. When they're ready to go off for vacation, I go in and I fill in for them. With that, you know, it takes some time to get seniority, I guess, with the company, and then you can get your own permanent position. But usually whenever it comes to the ocean, the trips are always going to be a little bit longer. For example, I just got back from Africa. It took 35 days to get to Africa. So that trip essentially was about 3 months. It all depends on where it is that you're going and how many loads you have to load or unload and things like that. But a normal trip when it comes to oceans is about 3 months.
And that, as you say, there's the family at home holding things together with the sailor gone.
And historically, the Yemenis, as I alluded to earlier, they tended to, at least when they first got here, they might spend 10 or 15 years where they worked here and their families were in Yemen. So they would only go to visit once a year or once every 2 or 3 years. So that was even more stressful. But in the 80s, really, people started bringing their families here. And that's why we have such a large community here, because now it's become a local community, not just a transnational community.
Right.
So it's a little bit less stressful than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we're seeing real patterns in the early days. Life on board the ships was much harder than it is today. If your family's in Yemen and you're here, how are you communicating with your family? You know, through the mail, literally through the mail.
No Skype, no FaceTime, but now you've got that.
And it would take months for letters to come back and forth. And there are people who, and if you didn't have a home address, where would your mail go?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there are all these people who tell a story. Some of the older sailors that we talked to, a big part of their narrative is telling us how they kept in touch with their families. You know, if they ever had a phone call, how they would arrange the phone call, because maybe their village didn't even have a phone. You know, people would have to drive to the city to call. Mm-hmm. It was things like that. Whereas today, these guys have Wi-Fi on many of the ships, and they can watch movies all night long. And, you know, not that and they do, because they need to rest. But it's just the nature of the work has really shifted over the generations. It's become a little bit easier. And also, you go through a lot more training now. So I think the safety level has also increased for people on the lakes.
Plus, on the lakes, most of the time, you know, you're always within cell phone reception. So, I mean, unless you're making the trek across Lake Superior, there's probably a period of between 12 to 18 hours, maybe max, of not having any cell phone reception. So for the most part, a lot of the vessels on the lakes don't really have like Wi-Fi. They're very old vessels.
Mm-hmm.
I think the newest vessel on the lakes was made in 1981 or put into commission in 81.
Mm-hmm.
So very old. And they don't have that. You know, a lot of the vessels don't.
So you just need a good cell phone plan.
Good cell phone plan.
Good cell phone plan, right.
I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you've been sailing on the ocean, you've sailed on the Great Lakes, and for most of the people hearing us talk right now, they know the Great Lakes from sitting on the beach on a sunny day, splashing in the waves, and enjoying that gentle experience. Give us a sense of what it is like to be way out there during a storm.
Ooh, quite nerve-wracking. It can be very frightening, actually. You see waves crashing over the deck, strong winds, and if you're in your bunk at the time, you're doing whatever you can to hold on so you don't fall off of your bunk, and making prayers that, you know, we stay above the water. It's quite an experience, to say the least. On the lakes, I've been fortunate. I haven't gotten to experience any of those really bad storms. I mean, smaller storms, you know, just rain, high winds and everything.
The Edmund Fitzgerald kind of mega storms, you have not.
No. Yeah. And for the most part, just from what I've heard from people that have experienced that, you know, they're doing a lot to try to prevent ships from enduring that kind of weather. So, you know, they're doing their best to keep up on the technology with like the radar and the Doppler, and weather shifts relatively quick. So, you know, you got the guys working in the pilot house, you know, doing their best to make sure, like, oh, okay, we see something brewing up. We might want to either check back, you know, wait to see if this is going to pass by, or, you know, drop the hook if it's looking really bad. And it helps keep us and everybody out of danger. And essentially, that's our lives at stake. I mean, to me, I think that's very valuable.
One of the people that we'd interviewed for the project was on the ship that passed through that strait right before the Edmund Fitzgerald. And he described that as the worst experience of his life. It was terrifying. It was clear that the waters were perilous. And they radioed back to say, you know, this is it. But the ship was already there. And then, you know, they kept calling and they weren't receiving a signal back. So they were the ones that alerted the Coast Guard. People are very aware of how dangerous the work is. And that's part of why, when I said they described it as a kind of prison, it's a very frightening place to be in a storm. And also just the winter, I'll share some footage with you of just what it looks like to be on one of these ships going through a channel in the ice. It's sort of beautiful and mesmerizing because it's something that most people don't experience. Right. But it's also, it's nerve-wracking. Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. You're aware that that's ice and that ice has the power to destroy the ship if circumstances change.
Well, we all know the story of the Titanic.
Yes, so.
Indeed. What do you like most about the work you do on the lakes and on the ocean?
I got to say it's going to places that I've never been to before and places that I can say I probably would have never been there had I not been on a ship. Prime example, my last trip, I went to Africa. I went over to Mombasa, Kenya, and I went to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Two places I would never even contemplate, you know, going if I had the means or when I do have the means. It's just, it's not even a thought. So doing what I do, being able to work on the lakes and go in oceans, you know, I get to see places and get to meet new people, experience things that without doing what I do for a career, I would have never been able to experience.
Sally, I know you say ultimately all this body of work you and your students are doing as you kind of dig into the history of Yemeni Americans on the Great Lakes, it will go to the Arab American Museum. How important is that museum in sharing the history, not only of Yemeni sailors, but of the contributions of Arab Americans?
There's nothing like it in the country. I mean, it's a wonderful institution. The Arab American community is old, it's diverse, it's large, it's dynamic. It's been an important part of the history of this region, clearly. It's also an important community nationally. And it's a community that I think is really misunderstood, especially in this political climate. So I'm just so happy that the museum is there and they're able to tell the stories of a whole variety of different kinds of Arab Americans. And this one little snippet of Yemeni history here in Michigan is critical to what they do.
We'll look forward to seeing all of that on exhibit eventually at the museum. We've been talking with University of Michigan Dearborn History Professor Sally Howell and Great Lakes sailor Jalal Albana. Thank you so much for sharing your life and your work with us and your passion for history. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy.